love, everybody. Ringo here. Beautiful day in LA. Talk. So, it was good to be able to kind of get it out in a song.
The whole, you know, origin of where we're all coming from.
I'm prepared for death because I don't believe in it. I think it's just getting out of one car and getting into another.
We're going to be reviewing one of the most successful of the solo Beatle albums, certainly the most successful one for Ringo, simply titled Ringo, which came out in 1973, in just a few moments. But as usual, we have some Beatle news here to get to, and we have to bring up the big news, which broke last week, and it concerned the announcement that a new film on the Get Back, Let It Be sessions is officially in the works with Peter Jackson, who's the director best known for his work on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He has been given the task to work on this, and he's been given 55 hours of film footage to go through, as well as 140 hours of audio. And what has made many fans happy is also the word that in addition to this new film, the original Let It Be film will be reissued and restored. Along with this, it's like two separate films. The Let It Be film has usually been regarded in the context of showing the band struggling at the time, but Peter Jackson has a different view. I thought I'd read this quote from him. "I was relieved to discover the reality is very different to the myth. After reviewing all the footage and audio that Michael Lindsay Hogg shot 18 months before they broke up, it's simply an amazing historical treasure trove. Sure, there's moments of drama, but none of the discord this project has long been associated with. Watching John, Paul, George, and Ringo work together, creating now classic songs from scratch is not only fascinating, it's funny, uplifting, and surprisingly intimate. One thing I want to add to this, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Mark Lewisohn actually tweeted about this. And his tweet read, listen to this, "The Beatles did it, and now I've done it. An exhausting but exhilarating month's work comes to an end. Finally, I know how it was and how I've been wrong in all my past writings. We've all," in bold letters here, "we've all had it wrong. Roll on, Peter Jackson's film and my volume three." Volume three, we're waiting for volume two. Anyway, so your thoughts about this? This is really exciting. We have known for a while that certainly Ringo has said that Let It Be is in the works. Many of us have doubted it. You know, we didn't want to get our hopes up. But now we've been hearing about Peter Jackson getting involved. And I'm really excited about this. If we have two separate films here, bringing back the original Let It Be and then an entirely new film.
Yeah.
Ken, you want to say something?
Yeah, sure. I'm excited that Peter Jackson's making this film. I think, you know, as an imaginative storyteller and filmmaker, it will be interesting to see what he comes up with. I agree with Tom Brennan's quote there that I too hope that he does a better job than Ron Howard. I think in any kind of objective retrospect, Ron Howard really gave us a kind of vanilla-coated early Beatles years and kind of, not kind of, he convoluted British and American Beatlemania in some troubling ways in coming up with his documentary. Having said that, I'm very concerned that we're going through a lot of revisionary history lately. We heard it with the White Album, with you know, our good pal Giles there live that we both saw at the same time,
right?
Telling us that in fact, you know, they were hunky dory sessions and there was no animosity. You know, the spoken record is very clear on this, and it's even more clear, of course, with the Get Back project, because we have all those Nagra tape recorders rolling the whole time. We have direct quotes. I mean, there is a lot of drama going on, and there's substance abuse taking place in the darker corners of heroin. There are people openly mocking each other's creativity, particularly from the mouth of John Lennon at times, being in the dark place he was. So I'm concerned that we're about to go into this space where some of this might be sugarcoated unnecessarily, because some of the principles are still alive and would like to, I don't know, feel more nostalgic and sentimentalized about the past. So there's a clear trend taking place over the last couple of years. I prefer, without any animus toward Peter Jackson, I would rather just have the restored movie and nothing else.
I wouldn't want to see footage you've never seen before. You wouldn't want to see
footage? I would like every inch of the footage, but I don't need it to be recut by him and formed into a nonfiction documentary. We can take the original text that we all would like in glorious Technicolor. We would like the full footage involved with the rooftop concert. I want all of those things, but I don't need it to be repackaged for me in some way. They can be DVD extras so that we can explore that footage sort of unmitigated by a documentarian's perhaps flowered lens. Mm-hmm. And I say all of this prejudging it in unfair ways. I mean, another one of the comments just noted very, very rightly, I think, that Peter Jackson deserves a lot of credit for his recent nonfiction exploration of, what was it, the First World War. Yeah, which was magnificent. So to be fair to him, I don't like prejudging a work of art or artifice that I haven't seen yet. So I guess my red flag is going up and saying, I do have some concerns that we're going into a space where we're doing some revisionary history. And the problem with that came clear to me recently. I was with our good colleague, Ken Daschau in New York. We were doing a podcast. Mm-hmm. And Ken was busying himself with something in another part of the studio, and I ran into this engineer. And I'll try not to go on too long-windedly, but it was really a great anecdote that I want to do a lot more thinking about. Anyway, it was, very fascinating because we were talking at that moment about the White Album remix, and I said, well, I really enjoy it, et cetera, et cetera. And this guy said, well, I think it's very good, but I wish that it didn't exist. And I said, why is that? And this engineer fellow there at iHeartRadio said, the problem is that each time a new version appears, it becomes the de facto version. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, when you bring up the Beatles now on Spotify and Apple Music, which White Album is going to come up first? Which White Album is being pushed by the powers that be? It's the White Album remix, right? And so there is this kind of diminution, it's late, the diminution of the originary artwork that occurs, right? And while I love having the White Album remix, and I adore it, I adore its presentation, but, it is problematic because it is not the intentional work object. That's not a disputed point. That is the album that they mixed in October 1968. And the same thing is true here. Michael Lindsay Hogg made a movie in 1970, rather a documentary. That's the originary object. That's the one that has John Lennon in tears with Jan Winner and their wives later that year, right? In a West Coast empty movie theater as they saw Beatlemania spilling out and dying in front of them. So, there's value to that, and I'll stop pontificating now. But
yeah.
clearly I'm concerned, but of course I can't wait like you, I'm sure, to get my hands on all of this and take a look at it. And just seeing those beautiful moments of footage of the rooftop back in the early 90s from the anthology has me giddy with the idea of having the whole damn thing.
Mm-hmm. I certainly have my thoughts, but Tom, let me hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I totally agree with Mr. Womack over there. This trend that, things were, better than what we thought. You know, I don't necessarily buy, you know, I'm one of the people that I, one of the bootlegs that I do own is that 86 disc of the Get Back Sessions. And, you know, you do hear, you know, it's not always, you know, lovey dovey and, you know, we're having a great time doing these songs over and over again, rehearsing them. You know, if anybody that's been in a band, they know that there's going to be some kind of, you know, fighting and jealousy or whatnot. Somebody, you know, like Ken pointed out, is on drugs, or somebody is taking over that, you know, wasn't the boss before, and now they're, you know, commanding, you know, all this, you know, energy put into this project. But however, the one thing I'm very excited about is the Let It Be movie itself. The fact that the integrity is going to stay intact. When Paul did that interview late last year, he's talked about how we were going to get a re-edit of the movie, I believe he said. And mm-hmm. I was completely worried that they're just going to take out that 2 minutes of that silly little, you know, row that really didn't mean, you know, anything to us, I don't think. But it's just that I'm excited about that. Speaking of the 55 hours of footage, that's going to be another wonderful, you know, fly on the wall type moment to see all this extra footage. I mean, what are we? We're a solo Beatles show. I mean, look at all these wonderful, you know, solo Beatles songs that started during these sessions.
That's true. You know,
that's going to be a wonderful thing to talk about when the set does finally come out. I'm predicting probably January of next year, maybe, or even May when, you know, I think the movie premiered in May. You know, so, mm-hmm. you know, so there's a lot to look forward to. Is there sugarcoating going on? Yeah, probably. But I guess we'll just have to wait until we see it ourselves.
Okay. Kit, your take on it.
Yeah. You know, at first I was worried because the interview Tom just referred to, absolutely, when Paul was talking about a re-edit, I thought, you know, it's me. I agree with you, Ken, that, you know, I don't like when history is altered and sugarcoated a bit, because, you know, it was a difficult time in many ways, and they were, you know, starting to grow apart in many ways. And it wasn't all fighting. It was just that they were all kind of, you know, they were having families. They were, you know, starting to, you know, want to do their own music. And so, you know, it was a time of conflict, but it was also, of course, as we all know, a time of great creativity. And I think that I'm now less concerned because, yeah, from reading Peter Jackson's comments, yes, I think they're going to do, you know, his version is going to be more upbeat. I mean, I think we can sort of, you know, from reading between the lines, or not even that, in those comments, you know, saying, oh, it wasn't all that bad, you know. I mean, he's sort of saying that. And, you know, so I think we can expect that. However, the fact that they are going to release the original version too, that made me breathe a sigh of relief. I thought, mm-hmm. oh, good, they're not just going to delete that and you know, put it in the back of the closet, so to speak. So I'm looking forward to the remastered, restored version. But, you know, on the other hand, even though we all have the concerns about history being rewritten, I am looking forward to this footage that they were referring to. I hope it's true that they're going to include a lot that we haven't seen, or perhaps we've only seen in, you know, bootleg footage. And so again, you know, as Tom said, it'll be a further fly on the wall experience. So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic. I'll put it that way, particularly after the Ron Howard experience that, you know, a lot of people didn't find as, you know, the end product wasn't quite what they thought it was going to be. So hopefully, I mean, Peter Jackson's a great filmmaker. So I'm hopeful that he will, you know, respect the material and not try to completely rewrite history. So as I said, cautiously optimistic.
Real quick, I mean, let's not forget, I mean, this Let It Be film has been ready since, I believe, 2004. It's been ready to go. I mean,
the restored one, you mean?
Yeah, the restored version, yeah. You know, so, I mean, I don't think there's going to have to put too much work into it, so.
I don't know if they've done any further work since then.
Right.
But I'm certainly very excited about this because, you know, What's really strange about this is that about a year or so ago, I watched Let It Be for the first time in well over 10 years. And it wasn't as depressing a film to me as I thought it was going to be. Mm. You know, it's got this reputation as being very depressing, and you see the band breaking up. To me, it's a normal band going through problems like anybody else. You know, the heaviest moment is that argument between Paul and George, and that wasn't all that much to me anyway.
Right. But, no, it certainly wasn't. And actually, the heavier moments are not in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. But there could have been a lot of joyous times during those sessions. And there's nothing wrong with showing that, too. You get a fuller picture that way. So, you know, I'm excited about seeing any footage that I haven't seen already. And anything that I've learned about the Beatles that's new to me is something that I'm excited about. If you see something in these sessions that really excites you and you see that they were also having some good times, I can't believe, like with the White Album, it wasn't all bad. It couldn't have all been bad. We actually have on these recordings from the outtakes, them joking around, you know, and saying positive things during the sessions. It wasn't totally negative. So it's important to get both sides of the story there, as far as I'm concerned.
And actually, so. That's funny that you say that, Ken, because I'm showing a comment on the screen right now from our friend Rob, who watches us pretty much every time. So hi, Rob. And he said, you know, allowing for different perspectives isn't a bad thing. It can lead to new understandings, sharing a new perspective. And he also brings up Dr. Ken's George Martin book, saying, you know, you didn't, you know, you're not revising history, but you added another perspective to it, another level to it, and isn't that a good thing? You know, so it's definitely, I mean, it's, you know, having different points of view and all is, you know, certainly not a bad thing.
Hmm. So, I totally agree. It's all about the curation, though, of the point of view, right? How is it delivered to us? And that'll be very important. Peter Jackson, you know, who am I to question him? Obviously, he has his bona fides, as they say, are enormous. You know, he's a master storyteller. This is a different kind of storytelling, though. I'm very curious about, you know, Mark Lewisohn's remarks as you read them earlier, Ken. Yeah. You know, this will be one of those we have to wait and see. How long will we have to wait and see, do you imagine?
Oh, I'm sure they're going to do everything they can to get it out there for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
Everything is all about anniversaries these days.
Right.
As you've lamented.
You know,
the big question is whether or not Paul McCartney will let Peter Jackson release his version of the original version of Get Back, or, you know, him singing White Power, you know.
Oh, no.
Are you talking about, like, the Let It Be probably audio box set that we're going to have?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if Peter Jackson would be behind that. That would be probably something else, like Joss Martin.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
true.
That team. So, Anyway, a few other news items here. Last week, Ringo announced a bunch of dates for his upcoming U.S. tour with the All Stars for what will be the 30th anniversary of the All Star concerts, running so far from August 1st through September the 1st, a total of 16 dates so far. Paul McCartney has added another date to his Freshen Up tour, and that's in Vancouver at BC Place for July 6th. So far, the only Canadian date of the tour. There's a brand new radio special to promote the box sets for Wildlife and Red Rose Speedway, which you can actually stream yourself on Paul's own website, paulmccartney.com. Paul has also revealed the front cover of his forthcoming children's book, Hey Grand Dude, which is also on his website. It's due out in September. Paul is working with Toronto-based illustrator Catherine Durst on the project, and she says it's just really amazing to talk to somebody who's not only a legend but such an inspiring artist. This is a guy who doesn't need any more fame or money, but he just genuinely wants to create an amazing book for kids.
You know, Ken, I look forward to when they recut that for the 10th anniversary version.
Don't give him any ideas.
With the help of Stephen King, right? Or something like that?
Yeah, no, I think it's M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan, okay.
You know, there are people who live and breathe anniversaries now, and I just think it's overdone. You know, I'm all for celebrating anniversaries, taking note of it. I just don't, you know, live and breathe it every day like some people do. Also, for those of you that live in the UK, I hope we have some followers in the UK, the Ruddles are back on the road.
Woo!
We'll be doing 21 dates in the UK, all marked for May and June of this year. And we only really lightly touched on this in our last show, but Tom, you had some information about low-key releases, as it's being described, being reissued. And I just want to mention the dates for some of these. There's the Linda McCartney album called Wide Prairie. That's, you know, it's all the songs that Linda recorded during her times in Wings. It's a compilation through all the years. And that's supposed to be reissued May the 3rd. Wings Over America, June the 7th. The rest of these are all June the 7th.
Right.
Wings Over America, the Russian album, Paula's Live, Amoeba's Secret. And all are being made available on black vinyl, colored vinyl, and CD Digipak.
Right.
All right?
Yeah. And if I can just add, you know, David and I, we interviewed the gentleman yesterday that's responsible for the inner sleeve of the gatefold of Wings Over America, Jeff Cummings. And he told us that late last year he approved the image that went on that particular reissue. So he pretty much confirmed that this will be coming out at some point this year.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Okay. Very good. Also, just want to make note of the fact that today marks the 17th anniversary since Paul's current band has been together.
Wow.
Okay. So it really all started when Brian Ray joined the band for the Super Bowl, for the halftime show. So just think of it that way. So they've been together all these years, so many concerts, so many wonderful moments. And congratulations to the guys.
And the halftime Super Bowl show just hasn't been the same.
Nope.
It certainly wasn't yesterday.
That's for sure.
Gladys Knight was fantastic.
She killed. Absolutely. She sounded great.
Yeah. So today's show, we're going to be covering this album. This is my original album. You can tell how the front cover is worn out. And Ken is celebrating with a Scott Erickson t-shirt here. Yes. I've added my own artwork to the album right here.
Oh, nice.
See how faded it is at certain points. But this is the Ringo album from 1973. And by far and away, the most successful album of his career. And so we're going to be reviewing that album for the rest of the show. And at this point in Ringo's career, well, he had started releasing two albums in 1970, his album of Standard Sentimental Journey, and that was followed by his country album, Buku's of Blues. Both those albums charted. They didn't do that well, you know, but still respectable. But nobody kind of expected Ringo to start off his career out of the gate that way, a very unusual way to start his solo career. And then after that, he had the two big hit singles, It Don't Come Easy in 1971 and Back Off Boogaloo in 1972, both produced by George Harrison. And It Don't Come Easy also, in recent years, Ringo admitted George helped him write the song.
Yep.
And I don't know if you guys even noticed this, but Back Off Boogaloo was always listed as being written by Ringo alone.
Alone, right, yeah.
On the last album from Ringo, Give More Love, where he has on the CD four bonus tracks where he redoes certain songs like Photograph and Back Off Boogaloo. It actually says on there, Starkey Harrison.
Okay. Oh, I
had always thought I'd always thought it was a Starkey Harrison composition anyways. So,
yeah. No, I didn't know that he added that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that must have been an agreement that that the two of them made together.
Right.
Same thing as Lennon McCartney made an agreement together for their songs. Mm-hmm. But so that was all followed by the Ringo album, which is such a tremendous album when you look back on it. And he had three huge hit singles from this album. Photograph, which went to number one. You're 16, also a number one hit. And that was followed by Oh My My, which went to number five in the country. And thank you, Tom. And the Ringo album itself went all the way to number two. He almost had a number one album there.
Yes, and but no one was stopping Elton John at that point in time. So.
No, it's the hottest thing on the planet.
Yeah.
It's just like when London Town came out and I was pushing for it to go number one.
Yeah.
You couldn't stop. You couldn't stop Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
At that time. So, yeah. But the Ringo album, so successful, and we all know that the other three Beatles helped him out on the album. So many other great musicians are on the album, like Billy Preston, Nicky Hopkins, members of the band. Just a tremendous, tremendous album coming from Ringo. I do want to make one quick mention here that I think that this album was very influential in the way that Ringo followed his career, because from that moment on, everything, number one, was the pop album. He didn't go back to making a country album, even though Buku's the Blues has really gained a lot of respect over the years. And there are a lot of people who wish he'd go back and make a country album again. But his albums all had pretty much the same kind of format to them. They all had 10 songs, 5 songs on each side for them in most cases, except like Goodnight Vienna Reprise, something like that. But for the most part, it's 5 songs on each side. He'd cover a song from the 50s or 60s, one song on there. He'd get his best friends on the album. Sometimes there'd be Beatles. There'd be so many other friends that he has. They all played on his albums, although Bad Boy was not that way. But that was pretty much the format until the Mark Hudson era, really. Even Time Takes Time had 10 songs. But really a remarkable album when you look back on it. And I want to get each of your assessments of the Ringo album. Why don't we start with Ken? This is actually Ken's idea to review this. As I was saying before the show started, I said this was like three box sets ago. He came up with this idea.
Why? So, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on the album.
I think your assessment of the packaging and all of the way in which it's emerged almost formulaically really did define almost everything that's happened since, and certainly through, as you noted very astutely, the Mark Hudson period, or Mark Rivera too.
Yeah, he's great.
But in any event. You know, that cover to me is so very important that both you and Kit and I really feel like we were left out of tonight's cover choreography. as you know, I do have it ready on my phone.
I'll throw you the CD version. Okay.
But the point is that cover with its almost cartoonish, not almost, it's cartoonish. This kind of cartoonish version of him is kind of a continuation of his Beatles persona that he adopted, right? So it really is the, God help me for saying this, the concatenation of that persona that he had derived all those years. So it does fulfill exactly what you said. It is Ringo with a little help from his friends, and how many friends he does have, right?
Right.
He does reach his high point with this record. Part of it is what makes the Beatles great too, of course, and that is their just legendary moments of songwriting up and down this record. I'm the Greatest, Photograph. Those are tremendous songs on anybody's album. You know, not just Ringo's. And as Tom and I were talking about earlier, even the way the album ends is brilliant. You know, it has, Ringo's easily his finest ending for a record. And, you know, as old George Martin would have said, the way that records begin and end, certainly sides, is vital to how we sequence them in our memory. So, you know, it has a lot going for it. I do think it's his best album. The thing that leaves me with sadness for such a happy record that I like thinking about in my own personal museum of recollections, to quote a Paul McCartney album that we'll undoubtedly be discussing during its anniversary later this year. When I think about this album, it is such a happy record for me. I remember vividly getting it for the first time and experiencing it. While it is such a happy record, it is tinged with sadness because he never reaches this level again. He has moments, as we all do, right? but it's never quite the coalescence again of the, of this record.
Okay, I don't totally agree with you on that, Ken.
I know, and I can't wait. I can't wait till our mind game slugfest that we both know is out there.
Ding, ding.
There's one thing I would add when you're talking about the songwriting of the Beatles. It's one thing to write a great song, but it's another thing to write a great song that's perfect for another person. And in this case, the other Beatles knew how to write for Ringo. But it's kind of ironic in the case of I'm the Greatest, when John started writing that song, and that was at the end of 1970, he wasn't thinking about Ringo then. That was just one of his own songs. And he also knew he couldn't possibly get away with putting that out himself. People would be saying, what an egomaniac, you know, and people would be thinking that. But Ringo can get away with it. But it just so happens that it worked for him, you know. And, and also 6 o'clock. I mean, that's one of the best songs of his entire catalog. And Paul wrote the perfect song there for Ringo, without a doubt. Perfection from the start of the song to the end. And Tom, let me get your take.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Womack made a lot of great, good points. You know, is this Ringo's, is this a great album? Yes. Is it Ringo's best album? Probably, but it'll most mainly go down as probably his most recognizable album. A couple of things. Yeah. Went to number two. You know, you had three Beatles on one song. This is the first time, and I think the last time it happened, that they were all in the same studio with Klaus Voormann and, you know, ex-buddy, you know, Billy Preston. So how much closer to a Beatles reunion can you get? You know, that was, you know, another important thing about this album. Two number ones. You know, who would have thought that Ringo would have got, you know, two number ones on one album alone? I mean, that, you know, you would figure, you know, Paul would have done that, or, but it hadn't happened. The closest I think it came was Double Fantasy, where John had a number one and a number two. So that, you know, is very important. You know, you said a little help with friends. Well, this was a lot of help from a lot of friends. You know, the people, Ken Michaels, that you said earlier that helped him out on this album, you know, yeah, he's got a lot of friends. And if you don't think that Ringo is respected and loved, just look at this album and Goodnight Vienna as well. People came out, you know, by the droves to help him out, and they wanted him to be successful, you know, with this album. You know, Richard Perry, you know, what can you say about, you know, the producer who first worked with Ringo on Sentimental Journey? This guy was on top of his game. He had a number one with Without You. He had a number one with You're So Vain.
That's right. Simon.
You know, so he was on top of his game. So what a great producer, you know, to work with Ringo. And, you know, they got to work together. I think it was on Son of Schmelzen, was it? Is that the name of the album?
Nielsen Schmelzen.
No, yeah. But the second one, the one after. Son of Schmelzen.
That's a hell of a point, by the way, Tom. Yeah. I mean, that Carly Simon album, No Secrets.
Right.
It has a lot in common with this record. In fact, Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney are also on that.
Right.
But two records have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really, and that too is a with a little help from my friend situation.
Right, exactly. Right. And then, you know, he starts a writing partnership with Vinnie Poncia that would, I think, continue up until Bad Boy. You know, and then the other thing is, you know, he was the third Beatle to have two number ones. At this point, Paul had two number ones and George had two number ones. So, and then who doesn't have any number ones at this point in time? And it's probably the person you think would probably have multiple at this time, and that's John. But, you know, in a way, I feel like he didn't need to do this album. He could have kept on going doing singles. He was having a pretty, you know, not a blockbuster movie career, but he was having a pretty successful movie career, as, you know, he was directed the Born to Boogie, which did pretty well and got cult status for Blind Man and got critical reviews for That'll Be the Day. So, you know, he could have.
Magic Christian did well.
Yeah, Magic Christian did too. So he didn't really need to do this, but, you know, apparently he felt that that it was time to get back in the music you know, album-wise, and, you know, glad he did. So this amazing album, but I think it's an important album for him. So, you know, I think all the stars needed to align for this to happen, and they did.
Yeah, thanks to one of our viewers, Rich Kutwika, who said Ringo-Rama is a great album too, and me, Mr. Mayo, put in a vote for Time Takes Time. So that's his second album. Kid, how about you?
100%. It's my second favorite.
Okay. So what's your thoughts, Kit, on the Ringo album?
Well, you know, Tom was just talking about the stars aligning, and I think that is the perfect description of this album. This is what happens when you get a great producer who understands Ringo, you know, understands how to present him, and, you know, what songs will fit his personality. Obviously, of course, you also, you know, he had, Ringo had connections, to say the least. And, you know, but he had, obviously, John, Paul, and George, who really know how to write for him. But chose other songs that, or Ringo would co-write other songs that just, you know, perfectly fit the, you know, his quirky sense of humor, his love of Western, you know, country Western, his love of, you know, Hollywood. I mean, you know, the, you just get the whole persona. And these songs are just so well crafted. I mean, somebody commented earlier that there really isn't a bad track on this album, and there really isn't. Right. It is a solid, solid effort. Ringo, I mean, you know, he doesn't have the strongest voice. I mean, he doesn't have, you know, a huge range, you know, but these songs are crafted to really, you know, take advantage of what he does have. He also just sounds like he's having such fun. You know, that's the other thing. You know, some of the other albums he did, some later ones, I mean, some of them he sounded like he was having a good time. Others, you just, you know, just thought, you know, I don't know. But this one, absolutely. You know, you could just hear that what was going on in the studio. And the players, you know, good God, the band, you know, Tom Scott, Nicky Hopkins, Bill Preston. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, these are top shelf people, and you hear it. So this is definitely what happens, as I said, when you get the best people, you get a producer who understands his artist, doesn't get in his way, but picks songs and helps him, you know, choose songs that best fit Ringo's personality, and you come up with this terrific an album. And a number of people have mentioned that, you know, well, that's a great album because it's as close as we get to a Beatles reunion. And that's true. But, you know, for me, it's as I said, it's more than that. You know, this is just, even forgetting the Beatles stuff, this is just a solid, solid album. You know, it's a strong effort. Even, you know, if you momentarily forgot the Beatles connections, they're just good songs.
Thank you for saying that. You know, one of the things that I love about this album, I just want to, you know, bounce off what you just said, is that if you take a look at the 10 songs, 6 of the 10 had involvement from the other Beatles. But the other 4 songs are really great songs, too. I mean, one of them is Oh My My, which became a huge hit. In all my years on the radio, I get a lot of requests for Devil Woman. A lot of people think that's a really great rock song from Ringo. I even remember somebody yelling out for it at a Ringo concert, you know, requesting it from the band. And for that matter, Have You Seen My Baby is a terrific track, which was written by Randy Newman. I don't know how Ringo was aware of that particular song, but it's great, great recording of it. And to me, that could have been a single. Where we were looking at a time then when you were starting to get albums with 3 singles, which hadn't happened before. So, and later on, as you well know, in the Fleetwood Mac Rumors period, and then, my God, Thriller. Yeah. You had so many singles from albums. You could have had more singles from the Ringo album. I think Have You Seen My Baby could have worked as well. But,
I mean, you mentioned that Have You Seen My Baby. I think that may have came from Harry, because he did an album of all Randy Newman songs. So I don't recall if that was before or after this, but that may have came from Harry.
That's possible. Okay. Yeah. But go on.
Not sure.
You know, yeah.
Oh no, just that's what really strikes me. And even you guys were showing the cover art for a minute there. I mean, that just sets up the whole album, doesn't it? It's like, you know, he's putting on a show for you, but in the best sense. I mean, he's not masking, you know, himself. And I mean, we talked about before we went on the air, the opening song and closing song are perfect. And they just complete the performance. I mean, they just, you know, here's the introduction of I Am the Greatest. I'm saying I was in the greatest show on earth. And right. Then closing with You and Me, Babe, where he's bidding everyone goodbye and thanking everyone who was on the album. I mean, it's just a really great way to structure the album. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. little like Sgt. Pepper, perhaps.
Yeah.
And you know, a little reminiscent of that. So, it's just really great. Somebody asked, Richard, does anyone know why Richard Perry and Ringo kind of split up eventually? And I honestly don't know.
No, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I know he also produced Goodnight Vienna as well. Right. But other than that, let's get a hold of Richard and find out. I mean, if Ringo was saying that the drinking and the drugs or whatnot was getting to him, maybe he could sense that, because he kind of got a feel for Harry, too. I know the second album he worked on with Harry, if you watch the Harry Nilsson documentary, he talks about how on that second album, you know, Harry kind of blew up a little bit, or just, you know, personal demons were getting in the way of the recording process. So
I'm wondering
if he was having deja vu.
Ringo moved to another record company.
Did we lose Ken Michaels?
Oh, do you see me?
Oh, we're going here.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, okay. Well, 'cause I don't see him anymore. So.
Yep. Oh no, he's here.
Okay. Hopefully I'll return to your screen.
I can't see or hear him. So.
Okay.
It sucks because he's the moderator.
As long as you can see Ken's cat over there, that's the main thing. But I was about to say,
that's
cool.
This is live. That's the excitement of a live broadcast.
Yeah. Dave's now eating a Ringo star.
Oh,
Dave, stop
there
eating.
There you go. Oh my gosh, that's funny, Tom. If you can't hear Ken, if you want, you can go back out and come back in.
All right, let me do that. All right,
okay.
I'll be right back.
Yep.
Yeah. So, my thought there was about Richard Perry after Goodnight Vienna, and then the greatest hits, Blast From Your Past. Ringo moved on to a different record company. Maybe that had something to do with it. You know, he started working with Arif Martin, with Ringo's rotogravure. So maybe he just wanted.
That's a good point too. And of course, back in those days, people made so many albums, and Perry was in huge demand.
Uh huh.
You know, it could simply have been scheduling, right? As we learned from Chris Thomas during our moment with him. You know, hot producers were all the rage.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. But, you know, you work in an industry where you're told if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And despite the fact the Beatles, when they were together, were anything but formulaic, you know, Ringo became, with his albums, it was like a formula. You would have thought that, hey, I'm doing well with the Ringo album. Goodnight Vienna went top 10.
Right.
Let's stick with Richard Perry.
But and Tom Brennan, folks, if you'll see, he's done the research. Well done, yes. Tom.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of what I thought. Since we were trying another label, we try another producer.
Okay.
So, kind of close to what I said.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
So,
hold on. I think I got a 3D shot of Dave.
All right. Oh boy. Yeah, some of you may know Ken not only loves his cats, he loves taking 3D pictures. So
I'm putting this up right now.
Good. Yeah. Be sure to do that.
If you're a Facebook friend, well actually you follow us on the show, he'll probably post it.
Yep.
So yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Vinnie Poncia, Kit, because he was Tom, I think you mentioned him.
Yeah, but, Tom mentioned him.
His songwriting partner of the 70s, and they wrote quite a number of songs together. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting part of his career, because nowadays, ever since Vertical Man, ever since that album, that was the first one with Mark Hudson as producer or co-producer. Ringo's actually co-written almost every song on his albums. And if you go back to the very beginning with the Beatles, yes, he had the two songs with Don't Pass Me By and Octopus's Garden. And he had the few songs that he wrote with George, including Photograph. But he really started to develop more as a songwriter in the 70s with Vinny. And in particular, if you go back to like the Ringo the Fourth album, it's a lot of songs on there the two of them wrote together. So if you want to see the development of Ringo as a writer, Vinny Ponti is so important in the history of Ringo. And I never hear Ringo talk about him.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, there's one song I would like to talk about on this album, and it's the lone Starkey credit, Step Lightly. And, you know, I didn't really think much of this song until reading the lyrics then and reading a little bit more about, you know, Starr's personal life at that point in time, where, you know, we all know how much he likes doing these, you know, semi-autobiographical songs these days on every album. I kind of almost feel like this one is a little bit like that, because I think we know that he was having troubles with Maureen and, you know, having an affair with Chris O'Dell at the time, you know, and then just like the lyrics, you know, I mean, I wish the song was yours, not mine. And then, you know, you got to find yourself a love that's going to last, and, you know, find yourself a love that's true to you. So I think that he also added a little bit of his personal life into this album as well. And I think that might've been like the first time we got a glimpse, you know, into that. And, you know, and I applaud him for doing that if that's the case, but I think it's a pretty good song, you know, after listening to it a couple more times these last couple of days. So I think it's an underrated song myself.
Well, we don't know for sure if that is the reason why he wrote it.
I just like to think that.
that's the Tom Hunyadi reader response.
That's right.
That was some real PhD kind of stuff
there,
buddy.
Hey, look out. I'm taking over there.
We got a place for you, buddy. I'd love to hear what people think about Oh My My, you know, which is a danceable ode. Also, yes, to quote the album that will be celebrating its anniversary later this year. I can't stop with the Back to the Egg references. But what do people have thoughts on Oh My My? I mean, it's like a proto disco song.
Yeah, I think it goes on too long myself. I think the single was 40 seconds shorter. I think it plays a little better that way. But I just think the repetitive Oh My My's towards the end of the song kind of made it drag a little bit. But other than that, I think it's a good song.
I love it exactly the way it is. I didn't think it went on too long. But it's catchy as hell.
And that was a favorite for me.
Yeah, the great sax solo in there from Tom Scott.
Yeah,
you know, really made it work. And again, the start of working with Vinny Ponti as a songwriter.
Now, Ken Michaels, is it true that Tom Scott is on solo records by all four Beatles?
Yep, I was trying to think if it was all four.
I don't think he was on John's.
Yeah, because I know he was. Yeah, he definitely was on George, Ringo, of course.
He didn't do rock and roll. I thought he did rock and roll. I mean, there's a lot of horn on rock and roll.
I have to double check.
Yeah.
But you know, it's years ago I did research on this, and I discovered that there's only two musicians that I know of that have been on solo records from all four Beatles. You know, and those two people, if you want me to tell you.
You have our undivided attention.
Go for it.
Are Eric Clapton and Nicky Hopkins.
Because
Nicky actually did some work with Paul around the time of Flowers in the Dirt with Same Love. He's supposed to be the piano player on that. So those are the only two that I'm aware of. I don't think Tom Scott played on a John Lennon record. We'll have to double check on that.
Yes. Yeah. Or a viewer will probably.
I feel like Tom's checking right now.
Tom's Googling it up right now.
Tom, join us if you want.
I love negative. Okay.
No Tom Scott.
No Tom Scott.
I'm rock and roll anyways. So.
Okay. Oh, wait. We have a viewer. It's Annette. Hi, Annie. Whatever gets you through the night. Was Tom on that one?
What's that? Let's check.
Yep.
Check right now.
Yep, we will check. Well, while they're checking.
Get the Walls of Brutus CD out.
There you go. While they're checking, I will just mention that, I love Oh My My. I think it's what I love is, you know, people know me love, you know, I love my, you know, love that, love some soul and R&B, and that's got some in there. Even, you know, with Billy Preston, I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. His piano on that is just phenomenal. You even have Mary Clayton and Martha Reeves singing backup, I believe.
That's right.
Which is a great touch. And very catchy. I mean, it really showed to me that, you know, Ringo could really write a good, you know, really solid, and co-write, I should say, a really solid single. I mean, you know, that was just a natural single. I mean, I just had a hit written all over it to me. But I love that it has that soul element to it. I'm a big fan of that song. I really like it.
No, yeah. Negative. No Tom Scott.
No Tom Scott.
Yeah.
So far, I've been proven correct.
Okay. So your record is still...
We should bring up Photograph. I mean, what an amazing record that turned out to be. I would go so far as to say that it is definitely one of the best solo Beatles singles ever.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not only a great song, but it's the production on that was so remarkable. And I remember years ago commenting that it's very Phil Spector-ish, the production on that. And it's very ironic that if you look at the credits on Photograph, the arranger for that song who did the orchestration was Jack Nitzsche. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. And he was Phil Spector's right-hand man during the Wall of Sound period. So it's kind of, I didn't realize that till later on, but it really has a Phil Spector sound to it. I love the whole feel of it, the orchestration, the flutes, everything was mixed so well together. And I just think of Photograph as being an absolute masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was their third top five hit together. Whether or not George didn't take that songwriting credit like that we talked about earlier, but you know, it's too bad that they didn't. Well, I know they do. You know, you got I'll Always Love You. But you know, it's too bad that the partnership didn't flourish more throughout the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll still love you.
Good. Thank you.
He wasn't working with Whitney Houston back then. So.
No.
I mean, that's a great record. I think I love the lyrics. Very clever lyrics. I mean, typical of George, co-wrote this. I just like that it's not a straightforward love song. I mean, he's the main character isn't saying I'm going to get her back. Mm-hmm. We're going to get back. No. He's resigned to it. And so the whole song is this. I mean, it's upbeat in some ways. I mean, it's very catchy. You can sing along to it, but when you really listen to it, it's got a much more melancholy kind of undertones, which is really I think an interesting approach. You mentioned Ken, I believe you did. You mentioned the mixing. Absolutely. I mean, the production and mixing on all these, I mean, I was thinking about if you ever remastered this album, I don't know if there'd be that much to do because it's like that well done. I mean, I love the little touches in Photograph, the castanets, there are just some wonderful little moments in there that you can hear and just really delightful and typical of the whole album, as I said, just well produced, well mixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, a song that we should bring up, one I've always been curious about, is the last song from the album, You and Me, Babe. And the songwriting credits for that are George Harrison and Mal Evans.
Mm-hmm.
Notice that? So I've never known the extent of Mal Evans' contribution to the song. Have any of you ever heard anything about that? You got a co-writer's credit on that song, so...
No, I mean, from what I was understanding from... the Ringo book with a little help that came out a few years back. It was Mel's song and George helped him out with it by request.
It was mainly Mel's?
Yeah, it was mainly Mel's.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, there's a part in that song where you have these descending and ascending notes in their half notes, the da-dun-dun-dun, very reminiscent of what George Harrison did in the past with I Dig Love.
Oh, yeah, good point.
And also, if you want to go back to even You Like Me Too Much, you know, so that's a George Harrison thing right there. That's got to be his contribution.
Right.
So, but that's a song that wouldn't it have been great if Ringo ever closed the concert with You and Me, babe. I mean, and thank everyone in the band, you know.
Right.
It would have been so perfect. But the only people who would know it would be the people who have that album. And, you know, everybody should have the album. But most people, the mainstream public would know his hits, and that wasn't a single.
Absolutely. So,
another song I think we should talk about is Sunshine Life for Me.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting song in a way. Real hoedown kind of a feel to it. And the entire song is written in one chord. The whole thing is one chord. So that takes a lot of work, I think, to be able to build a song just on one chord alone.
Right. And what better backup than the band? I mean, their musical, you know, range is I mean, if you've seen their that documentary that Martin Scorsese directed, The Last Waltz, I mean, what they can do is phenomenal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they were perfect.
Yep.
It's a perfect arrangement there.
Yeah, I love Sunshine Life for Me. That is one of my favorites. It's just so I mean, we all know that Ringo loves country. I mean, that's no secret. But I just love how he just goes full out on the song. And as you said, Tom, I mean, having the band as your backup, you can't really go wrong. And George Harrison writing it. I mean, I love it. I love Ringo's, you know, delivery on it. It's just so joyful. I'm so glad we're revisiting this album, because this is one of those songs that I'd kind of forgotten about in a way. Like I hadn't thought about it in a long time, and listening to it again, I thought, wow, this is a great, great song.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. If you don't mind going back to Photograph for a second, when I was reading that same book that I mentioned a second ago, they were talking about how they, Ringo and George, recorded that song during the Living in the Material World session. And then I thought that was pretty interesting, and then how they ended up redoing it for the Ringo album.
So, you know, if they ever do put out some kind of deluxe box set on this, it'd be nice to hear the early version. A Photograph.
Yes.
So it's pre Richard Perry.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Also, You're 16. What a perfect cover. I mean, it worked so well with these musicians. And of course, we know Paul does the kazoo solo there. It was recorded. That part was recorded during the same time when they did 6 o'clock.
Right.
But I wish I knew why Ringo chose that one, or if someone just suggested it to him. But it was the perfect song to cover. And we responded here in the U.S. by making it a number one hit.
Right.
So I just think that he was so suitable vocally in that arrangement for that song. It was just the perfect arrangement for it.
Right. And then, like you were saying, you know, how he followed suit for the continuing albums. He also did, you know, songs like Only You, Hey Baby, and Where Did Our Love Go? And I think, you know, his voice suited those songs. I think he, you know, paying homage to those earlier songs that, you know, may have influenced him at some point or the other, I think was a great touch on all these albums.
Well, in the case of Only You, that was John's
suggestion, right?
Suggesting that song to him. But I don't know about the others.
Doing these kinds of songs, you know, I think was a nice touch for his albums.
Right. Right. Yeah. One of our viewers just commented, she get the name, loved George Harrison's vocals. You can hear the background vocals from George on Sunshine Life from Me. It's really mixed in there where you can pick him out. So, thanks for that comment there. And 6 o'clock. I said how I feel about 6 o'clock. I think it's one of the greatest of all Ringo's solo recordings. I want to get your opinions on that, Ken.
I like 6 o'clock a lot. It's Ringo. Ringo does have very strong vocals, and I wonder, do we have any reason why He really is in great voice on that record.
Well, the songs were suitable for him.
Right.
They were in his range,
right?
As we said before. And I also like, you know, Ringo's voice. He doesn't have a strong voice. You know, he's even said that he's not Pavarotti. He's admitted that. But, you know, his voice has character to it,
right?
And a warmth to it.
Right.
And his voice could be mixed up hot,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the total mix of the song. It'll be fine. He doesn't have to be buried, you know, at all. And it's mixed just perfectly on this album, on all the songs, really.
I would counter. I would counter with your question about 6 o'clock. And I would. What are folks' favorite songs on this record? What is your indispensable moment?
To me, it's a tie between Photograph and 6 o'clock. Those are the two greatest moments on the album for me. An album with 10 great moments. but if I had to pick, it would really be a tie between those two.
You know, I'd have to mirror that. You know, the production on 6 o'clock with the arrangements and the backing vocals, the harmonies on that track, you know, with Paul and Linda, you know, I think just add to the beauty of the song. And, you know, how can you go wrong with Photograph? That team with George and Ringo of George and Ringo, I think really this is their peak.
Mm-hmm. I love that synthesizer solo in the middle of 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too short. It's not too long. It's just right. It was perfect for the song.
Do we know if there's a Paul lead vocal on that on a bootleg somewhere?
I've never heard one, but you know of the longer version, obviously,
right.
of 6 o'clock, which was on the...
That'll be in the 2023 anniversary version.
But it's been released commercially, as you know.
Right.
It was on the cassette version of Ringo.
Right. It was a bonus feature on the Goodnight Vienna CD.
Which didn't make any sense. Why would they put it on Goodnight Vienna?
Yeah.
But, and I think it was also on the 8-track, if I'm not mistaken.
It was on the cassette, the 8-track. Yeah, the longer version. Yeah, and it was the shorter one on the LP. Yeah.
Every diamond in the sky is in your eyes. By Faith and Line, Tom Brennan. Thank you, Tom.
I'm glad he brought that up because that is to me the moment in the song where I think this is a Paul McCartney song. Like, I mean, it's the melody, you know, kind of the melody on that, the imagery. Every time I hear it, I just think, yep, that's a Paul composition. You know, I mean, it's just it's to me. I mean, there are other moments too, but that one's the giveaway for me.
Right.
You know, I do like the extended version. You know, in fact, well, we just talked about that on the Goodnight Vienna CD. And, I heard Steve mentioning that. And, I like it because I like the extra Paul vocals in there. It's you know, you could argue that, I don't treat you like I should, that, you know, it can get a little repetitive.
Exactly.
But it's a sing-along. You know, it's kind of, I mean, it particularly comes through on that extended version. I can't say it's my favorite on here, but it's definitely, you know, it's a fun track and kind of going back to what you asked Ken about his voice. I mean, it's just every one of these songs is written so much for Ringo in mind. I mean, you can just hear it in all these compositions and it really makes the best use of his voice.
Mm. Right.
I agree. Yeah.
So before we end the show, we were talking earlier about this being Ringo's best album, and I certainly think that it's one of his best. I wouldn't argue with anyone that calls it his best, but I do think that when Ringo followed this up with Goodnight Vienna, which was a good album, not nearly as strong as Ringo, and Mother's albums from Ringo's Rotogravure through Old Wave had some fine moments on them, but they weren't nearly as strong as Ringo. I think Ringo's career really changed once he did Time Takes Time. I think he put a lot of effort behind all the albums that have followed since then. I would definitely say that Time Takes Time is an album kind of like Ringo, which has 10 perfect songs from start to finish. Every single one of them is a winner. It's
and
a very
strong
album. Yeah, help from friends. But the difference between that and the Ringo album is that Time Takes Time had four different producers working with Ringo. And yet, with the exception of the Jeff Lynne songs, you wouldn't know it. But there was a real consistency on Time Takes Time, and I love all the work he did with Mark Hudson. I think those are all very solid albums, and he started doing more than 10 songs per album then. And then things really changed after that because he's been working with a lot of different songwriters, you know, like Richard Marx and Van Dyke Parks and, you know, Dave Stewart, those people. He's been working with a lot of different songwriters. His albums have a similar production feel to them, but they're very diverse musically, very different to me than the Mark Hudson period. But I really think that his career, he changed so much from Time Takes Time on. He really, I think, took his records far more seriously. And I think it shows in the quality of his work. So I have no problem with anyone still saying Ringo is the best album, but man, listen to Time Takes Time and the Mark Hudson period and the albums that followed. You know, you might think some of the post-Mark Hudson spotty, but it's got some terrific tracks there. But, you know, Ringo has been putting out quality stuff, in particular from Time Takes Time on.
Mm-hmm. I agree. You talk about the, you know, Time Take Time with four producers. You know, there's no reason why this couldn't have been an album with four producers. You know, John could have produced I'm the Greatest. George could have produced a couple songs. Paul could have produced, you know, 6 o'clock, you know. Mm. So, you know, it could have been a multi-producer album as well. But
but it worked just like this with Richard Perry. Right. Mm-hmm. You know,
I agree. Yep.
You know, Ken, did you want to bounce off what I was saying?
No, I'd like to pass on that. Thank you.
And X gets the square.
Kit?
I just think, you know, I mean, as I said, this was a real career peak for him. You know, again, solid production, just the perfect songs to fit his personality, and the most consistent for me. I mean, there were other, except Time Takes Time. That was the other one that I thought was strong and I think is criminally underrated, but that's another show. but I think, you know, that some of the other albums, they had good moments on them for sure. And I'm sure we're going to revisit this topic in future shows, but I think that this is the album where it was just one song to the next. I mean, even the ones that I didn't like quite as well, they're still really good. This was his strongest effort. You can sense the fun he had in the studio. And one of the questions I asked online is, does this stand the test of time? And I absolutely think it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I would agree.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So before we go, why don't we each talk about anything going on in our work that we want to share with our viewers? Ken, how about you?
Oh, I have nothing new to report other than it's an exciting time, of course, as you know, with so many anniversaries, Ken.
Rub it in.
Sure. In particular, I'm currently working on a presentation that I can share with folks around the country about the Abbey Road Medley, since it's such a poignant, not footnote, but coda to that wonderful career. So, and of course, the work that George Martin did. So I'm spending a lot of time really trying to hone something special.
Okay, very good. Tom?
Thank you, Ken. My appearance on Sam Weill's podcast, Paul or Nothing, is up. You can check that out. We talk about Get Enough. And Sam, we're thinking about you. Like I talked about earlier, we did an interview with Jeff Cummins, who was responsible for that inner sleeve of Wings Over America, the Thrillington album, Front and Back, the 45s of Temporary Secretary, Say, 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 and this one. He's got great stories regarding all of those pieces of art that he did. So that's up on our Podbean page. Just go to Podbean, type in Two Legs, and you'll see us right there. You can reach out to us on email at twolegspodcast.com or gmail.com, sorry. And find us on Facebook at Two Legs Podcast.
Okay. Kit, how about you?
My columns, Deep Beatles and Deep Soul, will be probably coming back by this weekend. They were a bit delayed because of the polar vortex last week when I lost internet for a while. But all is good now. So just check out my Facebook page, and you'll see whenever I post something new. You can also check out my website, which will show up right here. Here we go, kiddotool.com. And you can find out all the information there. So just busy. I'll be doing a new Bottomless Soul in just a few weeks, and I will be posting details about that too. So,
excellent. All right. As for me, the other podcast show for which I'm a co-host, Things We Said Today, we just did a show in which we interviewed Ken Mansfield, who is the former U.S. manager for Apple Records and also was a guest with us at the White Album Symposium. And he has a new book out called The Roof, The Beatles' Final Concert. We did a conversation with him where we talked about a number of things, his years working for Apple Records, and also what it was like for him to be on the rooftop. And he was there for that concert, which just celebrated what, Ken?
I believe it's the 50th anniversary. Hey, what? And did you get to the bottom, Ken, of that whole white coat business?
We never brought up the white coat.
Yeah, why the white coat?
Come
on.
Okay.
we need to blow that white coat story wide open.
Okay. All right. I'll have to email him. I'll come up with an answer. Okay. And in addition to that, on my website, kenmichaelsradio.com, you will find we have my Beatles trivia and games page where you can win one of 9 prizes every single week. And a new prize that I have to offer is this brand new Blu-ray for the movie Backbeat, which is all about the life of Stu Sutcliffe, his friendship with John, how that led to being in the Beatles, their time in Hamburg, and of course, his sad passing. And that's one of the 9 prizes you can win, as well as Kit's fine book, Songs We Were Singing, which I always plug here on every single show, Kit.
And it's a good question this week.
What's that?
I said it's a good trivia question this week.
Which is?
Well, I'm not going to say it now, but you posted it earlier.
Here, got it.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's true. You mean my trivia question?
Yes, okay. I'm saying your trivia question is a good one this week.
Yeah. You have to know your Beatles and solo singles for this one. Okay. Oh. So I'm sure many of you watching can figure it out. You can win one of 9 prizes. You can win Egypt Station. I got more copies of that on CD to give away, by the way. And lots of great stuff. So for those of you that want to get in touch with us by email, Tom, you usually have this information.
Yes. You can email us at talkmoresolotalk@gmail.com. You can find us on our Facebook page, Talk More Talk. And Kit, Twitter is talkmoresolotalk1, was it?
Yep. Yes, number one.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a trick quivia question for all three of you. Can you name 4 of the 6 women that Ringo thanked on this album, Ringo?
Oh, man.
Let me think. That is really minutia when you get down to it.
Are we allowed to collaborate on this?
Sure.
Please do.
Mo.
Okay.
Oh, yep.
Yep.
Did F1. He think Did he think Linda?
Yes, he thanked Linda. That's 2.
Okay.
Did he thank Yoko?
No.
May?
Who?
May?
No. Close. You're getting, I mean.
What about like Martha Reeves or Mary Clayton?
Nope. No. You guys give up? You want to just say it?
All right. Where were the other 2?
It was 6. It was Chris, who I'm thinking is Chris O'Dell, which he was supposedly, you know, with. Patty.
Yeah. Patty. Why don't we do this a lot in the show from now on?
Cynthia, Maureen, Tina, who I don't know, and Linda. So yeah, 6 women he thanked. And oddly enough, Maureen was number 5 on that list. So very weird.
Oh, George. Yeah.
Yes.
But that's another right. show.
That's okay. Yes.
Show.
So this has been great talking about the Ringo Show. Thanks for all the comments. Tell as many people as you can about this show if you're into the solo Beatles music. And we thank you for being here now. And this is Ken Michaels, along with Ken Womack, Tom Hunyadi, and Kit O'Toole, saying thanks for being here, and we'll see you next time. What?